This is the state of things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Your alarm goes off at 6 a.m. You slap together breakfast, feed the dog, pack your lunch, and you're off to work. But it's no sooner than you pull out of your driveway that you start to get that sinking feeling. I really don't want to go to work today. I've been doing a terrible job lately. My head aches. My stomach hurts. I couldn't care less about my colleague Barbara. And I'm not even sure that I like this profession anymore. If all this sounds familiar, these may be signs that you're officially burnt out. It's a phenomenon that became the subject of many think pieces, and one that the World Health Organization now officially lists as an occupational syndrome. Many who are suffering hear the same kinds of prescriptions. Meditate, make time for yoga, treat yourself to a spa day. But for many people, these self-care solutions are not solving the bigger problem of burnout. On this episode of our series Embodied, we're talking about this special kind of exhaustion that is physical and emotional. We'll talk to a variety of experts about the larger systems at play, and we will look at some of the solutions. Joining me first is Amelia Nagoski. She is the co-author of the book Burnout, The Secret to Unlocking the Stress Cycle. She's also a professor and music coordinator at Western New England University. Amelia, welcome.
Hello.
So we hear this term burnout all of the time, and everyone defines it a little bit differently. How do you define burnout?
In our book, we colloquially define burnout as the experience of being overwhelmed and exhausted by everything you have to do, and yet still somehow worried that you're not doing enough.
So we think about it as kind of this whack-a-mole, or at least I do. You know, when there's a stressful situation, I'm like, take care of this, take care of that. But you actually make a very specific point to break down the difference between the stress and the stressor. So tell me about that.
Yeah, the first thing to do if you're worrying about burnout in your life is to separate the stress from the stressor. A stressor is anything you can see, touch, hear, smell, taste, or imagine that causes your stress response in your body. So your workplace might be a stressor. Traffic is a stressor. But the stress is a cycle that happens in your body. And it's meant to be completed the way it was completed in the environment of evolutionary adaptiveness when we would run away from a lion and save our lives through that physical exertion and sort of run through all the neurochemicals and hormones that are associated with that stress response. But unfortunately today, the stressors like traffic and work, they can't be solved by running away or punching anybody in the face. So we need to separate the stress from the stressors and complete the stress response cycle separately and independently from dealing with the stressors.
So it's this physiological thing. Stress is actually adaptive. We needed to be able to run away from the lion, but now we have these non-lion stressors in our life, and we need to find a way to complete this stress cycle in a different way. Tell me about this kind of completion of the stress cycle.
Sure. All emotions happen in cycles. Stress is one of them. The stress itself is not bad for you as long as you go all the way through the end of the cycle. So say you're being chased by the lion and you run and you run and you get invited into someone's home. Come in, hide here. And you all hide together and the lion tries to bash the door down and you hold it back together. And eventually the lion gives up and go away. And you have fought and you are exhausted, but you're also elated. The sun shines brighter. You love your friends and family. You're grateful to be alive. And that is the complete stress response cycle. Now, say the stressor is traffic. So you've driven home and you've been terrible traffic, stop and go the whole way, and you pull into the driveway. And does anybody, when they get to that point, love their friends and family and the sky shines brighter? No, because you have not completed the stress response cycle. You have managed the stressor. You're out of traffic. You got home. But you need to do something that tells your body that it is safe. So you complete the stress response cycle from a lion by running and fighting. How do you do it from traffic? You run, you fight, you engage in physical activity, you connect with someone who loves you, who makes you feel safe, or lots and lots of other things. But it's not going to be getting home that solves the stressor. Sorry, it's not going to be getting home that solves the stress response cycle. That's just the stressor. You deal with that separately.
So what you're saying is there is the stress, it's physiological, and in order to not walk around with decades and decades of these uncompleted stress cycles, we need to find ways in our everyday life to complete these. So physical activity, you say, you mention a 20-second hug or a 6-second kiss. So these kind of physical things that we can do to tell our body, hey, you're safe, it's okay, this cycle is over.
Exactly. Creative self-expression, connection not just with other members of your family, but with the divine or with animals. There are lots of ways, but the important fact is that the stress itself is not the problem. It's getting stuck in the middle of the cycle that's the problem.
Okay, so we're going to talk a lot more about this cycle in a minute, but I want to bring in one more guest now. Actually, I do not. I'm going to stay with you, Amelia. So, okay, we've talked about the stress and how to deal with it. Let's talk a bit about the stressors. And you and your sister kind of dove deep into the science, but I want to actually take you back for a second and talk about why. And that was really because of a personal experience that you had while getting your PhD. So tell me a little bit about your own story of burnout.
Yeah, my doctorate is actually a DMA, a doctorate of musical arts, and it's in conducting. And I don't know if you know this, but conducting is a heavily male-dominated field. Mm. And there are lots of stressors in the world, in all kinds of workplaces, especially in academia. But for me, being a woman who was the only woman in my program, I remain to this day the only woman ever to complete the doctorate in conducting from that school. Even though lots of other men have completed it, it is a very misogynist field. So for me, the stressor was interacting in these misogynist ways with people who had a lot of power over me, and I could not express my frustration, and I didn't know about separating the stress from the stressor. So the stress just built up and built up, and about halfway through the program, I ended up in the hospital with stress-induced inflammation. And my sister came to the hospital and was like, "What is wrong with you?" And she has a PhD. My sister, Emily Nagoski, is the author of the New York Times bestselling book, Come As You Are, The Surprising New Science That Will Transform Your Sex Life. With her PhD in public health, that means that she expresses her sisterly love by bringing me books about the science of how to manage stress. And reading through these books and working through the strategies of separating the stress and the stressor, when she wrote her first book and she was surprised that all the emotion stuff in that first book was new to everybody, I reminded her how important it had been for me. And so she said, "We should write a book about that."
Okay, I want to play a clip for you now. So in the past couple of weeks, we've been reaching out to our listeners and asking them to share their stories of burnout. And I want to share this story from Krista Malo.
Hi, my name is Krista Malo, calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. And I had an experience with burnout as a high school science teacher. I started my high school science teaching career very eager, very excited, willing to put in the extra hours and really make a difference in my students' lives. And that lasted for probably about 3 or 4 years until I started noticing some symptoms of burnout. At first, it was just maybe calling out of work one day here or there, or noticing that my stress level was high. I started getting migraines, but all of it really didn't sink in until it really became to where I was not looking forward to going to work in the morning, and I wasn't looking forward to getting out of bed. And it was actually my significant other who kind of raised the flag. Once I realized that the burnout was happening, I started applying for new jobs and ended up going back to school to get my master's and got a new job. And it was still related to teaching, but I wasn't burnt out from the grading for 100 students every weekend or having to work 2 extra jobs. Because the pay just wasn't there, and I still had student loans that I had to take care of.
So that was listener Krista Malo sharing her experience with burnout as a high school teacher. I'm talking with Amelia Nagoski, the co-author of Burnout, The Secret to Unlocking the Stress Cycle. So one thing, Amelia, that strikes me so much about Krista's story is she didn't actually realize she was experiencing burnout. It took someone else saying, "Hey, this doesn't seem okay." And I know that's a parallel with your story. Can you talk a bit about kind of why it takes that extra person and how maybe burnout is different just from daily stress?
Sure. I think the reason a lot of us don't notice that we're burning out is because we're doing what we're supposed to do. We have learned from society that we are givers. We're supposed to give everything we have, our lives, our time, our bodies, especially those of us who work in caregiving professions like healthcare or teaching. Notice these are women-dominated fields. And we feel like what we're supposed to do is give until we have nothing left. There's the story of, you know, you have a cup of water, and do you give that cup of water to someone who needs it, or do you drink it yourself? Well, of course, what you do is you share it with someone else who needs it until the cup is empty, and then you're standing there with this empty cup. And if you're a giver who believes that this is your moral obligation in the world, someone's going to come up to you and say, "Why are you standing there with that empty cup?" someone else could use that cup, and you feel like you have to give that away too. So you don't notice that anything wrong is happening to your body because you're following the rules, you're doing as you are told, and it takes another giver, someone who comes over to your side and says, hey, you need support and protection. I'm taking this giver language from a book called Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny by Kate Mann. She posits this world where there are human givers who are morally obliged to give until they have nothing left. And that moral obligation would be fine if we were surrounded by other givers, just like it sounds like Krista was, thank goodness, had a support system that led her to see what she needed. The toxic situation at the high school where she was working was clearly the expectations that she would give, and no one's looking out or giving back to her.
We're going to continue our conversation with Amelia Nagoski, the co-author of Burnout, The Secret to Unlocking the Stress Cycle. Just ahead, we'll talk with some other guests, an activist, a nonprofit worker, all of that today on our episode of Embodied About Burnout. I'm Anita Rao. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. It's Embodied Today, our recurring series about sex, relationships, and your health. And we are talking about burnout. Chronic stress is often one of the key factors that leads to this specific kind of exhaustion. It's different for everyone, but symptoms can include feeling disconnected, emotionally overwhelmed, or depleted. My guest now, Rajvinder Semra, is a lecturer in the School of Health, Well-being, and Social Care at the Open University in the United Kingdom. She has spent some time looking into the history of burnout, and she joins me now. Raj, welcome.
Thank you.
And still with us is Amelia Nagoski, the co-author of Burnout, The Secret to Unlocking the Stress Cycle. So Raj, take me back into the history. When did we first start using this term burnout?
Well, a lot of people credit burnout to Freudenberger, who was a psychologist working at a free clinic in America in the 1970s. But actually, one of the first documented phenomena of burnout was in actually air traffic controllers in the USA. And in the end of the 1960s and the beginning of the 70s, air traffic controllers were reporting amongst each other and in their newsletters that they were burning out. And in fact, people didn't really know what that meant outside of it. And the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, commissioned a report looking into this psychological stress and burnout to try and work out if burnout was real. So actually, there is it's almost a 600-page report from 1978, because it took 4 years, of 400 air traffic controllers looking at whether burnout existed, and they concluded it did. So it actually goes back a little bit further than a lot of people think.
Well, that's so interesting, because when the term really came about, it was seen as particularly pertinent to caring professionals, so those that spend much of their time kind of meeting the needs of others. But that's not exactly what air traffic controllers are doing. So talk about what you learned from looking through the report about burnout in this particular kind of profession.
Well, I think that the term, it was used by different people. And so even though it kind of means the same, it means like being exhausted. And for air traffic controllers, they were feeling exhausted for their time because they felt that they would burn out. There was this idea that it would be at 40 and they would retire. But what's interesting about this is like a history lesson is that the things that were happening to air traffic controllers was they had poor training environments. They didn't have great equipment. There wasn't enough funding. I think it was from the government and economic policies. They had long shifts without breaks, and they were having to deal with automation and new technologies. So really that constant stress. It's not that they were directly caring for people, but people's lives and safety was at risk. So there's that constant stress of not caring, but definitely safety of people. That was at play. And so burnout, this history of burnout, it's kind of similar to today, where we feel like there's all these different facets of life that are chronically stressing us. But another thing that's important about the air traffic controller study was that these were not people that weren't considered resilient. 99% of the 400 air traffic controllers had served in the armed forces. So we would traditionally think that they are a resilient group.
And that's so striking to me, because I think there could be a tendency to think about burnout as, you know, people just don't want to work hard and they don't kind of want to show up to work every day and put their best foot forward. But that's actually not the case. People want to work hard. People are fine working hard, but people don't want to be working in an environment where they aren't treated fairly or the conditions aren't great or they're not trained properly. So it's not really a failure of human resilience. It's it's kind of something that illuminates that there are these other systemic problems.
Yeah, and another thing that's important, as an important finding, was that they compared the people in this study that did burn out with those that didn't. And this is counterintuitive, but those who did burn out, at the beginning of the study, at the outset, they had better psychological health. They had greater abilities to manage anxiety and stress, and they had lower alcohol consumption. And bearing in mind that the authors of the study were at Boston University School of Medicine, they were psychiatrists, so they were actually doing ratings. And they in the report's findings, they were trying to understand why you would get these people that had such resilience developing burnout. And part of that is people that have high professional and personal ideals, as they begin to work hard and overwork and they experience exhaustion, their answer is just to work more. And so really they conclude in the report that the highly competent workers were actually feared burnout. And once burnout began to happen, it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. So it's important to note that highly competent people can have burnout, and also people that you'd say are highly resilient. So those are interesting findings from that. I think more recently, we're finding that it's important to understand burnout's more likely to be a failure of recovery than resilience. So talking about all those stresses and the lion that keeps chasing everyone today, being under chronic stress and not having recovery, not having time not doing work, is one of the things that sort of underpins a failure to, well, recover and actually sort of puts people at risk of burnout. But recovery can literally mean just not working. It could be doing nothing. So in some of the studies, recovery is just half an hour not doing anything, or it can be TV. But it's not going to be watching TV whilst checking your emails, because then you're not recovering. So once we start phrasing it in that way, I think that people will be able to understand the burnout experience and what will protect people a bit better.
I want to play another clip now from a physician that we spoke with, A.R. Abdelbar. Let's listen.
I'm A.R. Abdelbar, and I'm a physician calling from Fort Myers, Florida. I started to know I was burned out at my last job when I started to have physical symptoms. Anxiety, night sweats, not being able to take care of myself, such as eating properly or exercising the way I normally do. When it became to that level, I really knew that this wasn't the right job and fit for me. I think there's a lot of factors that can lead to that. I think being in a profession where the people that go into it are generally hardworking, ambitious, want to do the most good for the most amount of people, but that can sometimes in a health system be hijacked and almost taken advantage of. I still think that I'm in the right profession, but I think some things about a particular job can really beat that passion out of you. And when it goes from excitement to your job to just really struggling to maintain your own health, that downward spiral kind of gives you all the information you need that's gone too far for you.
That was physician A.R. Abdelbar sharing his personal experience with burnout. And we are talking about this particular kind of exhaustion today with a number of guests. Rajvinder Semra from the Open University is with me now, as is Amelia Nagoski. So, Rajvinder, you heard this physician talking about his particular experience. And I know that you've drawn parallels from your research, and you've looked really particularly into physician burnout. Can you talk about what you heard in his story and maybe what some of the solutions are that are being proposed to address physician burnout?
Well, one of the things I think that sort of across people experience burnout is really, it's really hard to tell. It's really hard to identify it. And I think it's quite hard in the helping professions, of which physicians and nurses and teachers, I think that these positions where you're caring for people, it's a kind of minefield, because that idea that you want to help people, but you begin to burn out, you become more ineffective, because that's one of the consequences of burnout. You try harder, but in doing so, you might, in a way, unintentionally harm yourself and others. This is what we call pathological altruism. I think that downward spiral that he's talking about is so hard to identify. So one of the things I think we need to be thinking about is everyone's different. So it's important to identify changes in yourself. So the three components of burnout, which are emotional exhaustion, so
feeling worn out and depleted, and depersonalization and feeling cynical and detached from others, and then reduced personal accomplishment, which is not getting that reward or enjoyment from work, actually being less effective. There is no one-size-fits-all approach to identifying that, but we all know within ourselves when we're doing something out of character or something that used to be a challenge is now a threat. So I think identifying burnout is a key issue, and I think that narrative from the physician there, it sort of highlights that.
I want to bring Amelia Nagoski back into the conversation now. She's the co-author of Burnout, The Secret to Unlocking the Stress Cycle. So Amelia, one of the things we mentioned earlier at the top of the show that the World Health Organization has officially defined burnout as a workplace syndrome, and they did so earlier this year. And we've been talking about professions like teachers and physicians. But what strikes me is that we have this very particular cultural definition of what counts as labor. So if we say this is a workplace syndrome, we're thinking about people showing up in a place of work. But how about kind of all of the other types of labor that we do? How are those connected to burnout?
Workplace burnout is the purview of the WHO because workplaces are systems that can and should be subject to government regulation, which is where the WHO can have influence. But the dynamic that causes burnout in professional settings, like unceasing demands and unmeetable goals and dehumanizing treatment, all those exist in social and cultural settings also, but we don't have a way to regulate white supremacy or misogyny or homophobia in a way that will lessen the impact of these oppressions on individual health outcomes. So, for example, Serena Williams does not have to worry about workplace stress. She probably never needs to work another day in her life, but she's still a target of racism and misogyny and body shaming, all of which can be very stressful in the long term and can lead to burnout.
So there are stressors that may be easier to deal with, and there are others that are systemic, much harder to tackle, that maybe affect some people more than others. What did you all notice in the research about kind of tools for dealing with stressors, both those that are systemic and otherwise?
Well, the good news about being able to separate the stress from the stressor is that you do not have to wait for the end of white supremacy to stop suffering from the effects of white supremacy physically in your individual body. Because you can separate the stress from the stressor, you can deal with the stress itself in your body by completing the stress response cycle, by whatever works for you, physical activity, affection, connection with the divine, creative self-expression, a big old cry, a big old belly laugh. There are lots and lots of ways that you can deal with the stress in your body. And that actually gives you the rest and the power and the nourishment you need to strengthen you for the fight against stressors that cannot be solved probably in your lifetime, but need to be solved in the long term and need you here well enough, healthy enough, and strong enough for that fight.
One of the things I took away from your book was realizing how much we're all kind of striving for wellness as this static state of being. I want to be well. I want to get to the point where I can balance everything. I have that work-life balance. But you point out so clearly that wellness is not a state of being. It's a state of action. We need to be able to fluidly move in and out of this state of wellness. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Sure. When we say wellness is a state of action, it's the state of oscillation through all of the cycles of being human. So we feel like, oh, I need to be totally independent and be able to stand on my own two feet. Well, yes, sometimes, but we're actually meant to oscillate from autonomy to connection. I'm supposed to work really hard. Well, yes, you are. Welcome to, you know, doing what you have to do in the world. Fantastic. Thank you for that. But we're supposed to oscillate from effort to rest, from feeling stressed to feeling perfectly safe, which is why I say that stress is not the problem. Getting stuck in one place is the problem. And we get stuck because the world is telling us there's only one way to be. So the problem's not that we aren't trying or even that we don't know how to deal with our stress necessarily. The problem is really that the world has turned wellness into yet another goal everyone should be striving for.
I want to share another story from a listener, and this is a former lawyer. His name is Jack Wiggin. Let's listen.
Hi, I'm Jack Wiggin. I'm from Durham, North Carolina. My story of burnout, I guess, starts with my former career as an attorney. I was a 10-year practicing attorney. I worked at a small firm. I worked at a really big corporate firm, and I worked actually at my own firm. But at the end of the day, I think it was the actual being a lawyer, which burned me out. The long hours, the availability to your clients at almost all times, the serious demand on your time that is just kind of understood that lawyers kind of just deal with. At the end of the day, I just had to switch careers in order to allow myself to be happy and allow myself to live a life that I wanted to.
That was former lawyer Jack Wiggin sharing his personal experience with burnout. I am talking with Amelia Nagoski, the co-author of Burnout, The Secret to Unlocking the Stress Cycle. So what about that, Amelia? How do we know when it's time to give up or time to really switch gears, move away from a particular path that we've chosen?
Yeah, it sounds like the textbook list of unceasing demands, unmeetable goals, dehumanizing treatment. If that is the environment you're in, you may need to change that environment. We actually have a worksheet in our book about like when it's time to quit. You just make some pros and cons. The hard part about quitting is that after you quit, that creates a whole new pile of stressors that you need to address, including dealing with the stress itself that results from having made the decision to quit.
What about for people who feel like they don't have a choice? They can't afford to miss a paycheck. They have loans they need to pay off. They can't just quit their job.
Absolutely. This is one of the reasons that burnout is a social justice issue, because in addition to professional barriers to wellness, there are social and economic ones, as well as misogyny, but also race and class. And for the people who are just stuck working two jobs and raising kids by themselves, this is a larger systemic issue that has to be addressed, which is why the cure for burnout is not self-care, can never be self-care. The cure for burnout has to be all of us caring for each other.
The interesting thing, too, is that we really make a virtue of being exhausted. There have been a lot of think pieces earlier this year about workism and this kind of unrelentless need to define ourselves by our work. And I wonder, I mean, what do you think of that? How much of burnout comes from putting so much of our identity in that work bucket?
Yeah, we've discovered that one of the core reasons people burn out is they're trying to negotiate a gap between who they are and who the world expects them to be. So if the world is expecting you to be a lawyer who's on call, available to your clients all day, every day, but that is not you and who you are. So as you're trying to bridge this gap, it asks you to do things that are not part of who you are. And coming to understand that the expectations of the world are the things that are broken and wrong. It is not you that is broken and wrong. And making those two things reconcile is where the cure for burnout happens.
One of the strategies that you talk about in your book is changing your relationship to winning or to failing. And that struck a deep chord with me because I think it's something that a lot of professionals don't think about. They think there's an objective winning, an objective success, an objective failure. But that is actually not the case. We do have more power to decide for ourselves what failure and success looks like. How does that play into this conversation?
One of my favorite pieces of research that took the most convincing from my sister to make me believe that it's true was about positive reappraisal. Positive reappraisal is coming to understand that things that are difficult or anything that causes suffering is actually an opportunity for learning and growth. It turns out that it's true that if you, for example, assign students a reading in a difficult-to-read font, they're going to hate reading it. It's going to be really hard, but they're going to remember more of that content. So when you go through a period of your life that is too difficult, that you're like, I can't even, it turns out that that might actually be an opportunity for growth and learning and change. The pessimist in me wants to believe that, no, all suffering is a result of our universe being out to get us all. But it turns out, no, we do have the ability to take what we suffer from and turn it into something better. The only exception to that, the biggest exception to that, is being compared to others. That's a kind of challenge that's really mostly just toxic.
I only have about 30 seconds left, but Raj, I want to ask you one last question, and you're joining us from the United Kingdom. So I wonder, is burnout something that is unique to the United States? Obviously not, because you're looking at it and talking about it there. But can you talk about kind of the cultural narrative around burnout and how that differs?
Yeah, it's definitely not unique to the United States, but it is growing and increasing interest. So the research is coming from all across the world. And I wouldn't necessarily say it's just about capitalism or a US-style economic system, but it feels that high demands, which we're talking about, those demands of yourself or your professional ideals, and low resources play into this. So low resources, they they're the fact that our government's not necessarily spending as much money as they used to. So I think that that's not unique to a country or a system, but I think that is why we're getting it. So I can see research from burnout in Brazil is growing, and in China I've seen. So I think it's important to know that it's just happening, but it can be linked to the economic system in some way. And it's something that probably unites us. So there should be more effort to sort of bridge those, look at the variability or look at the differences and the similarities. But it's interesting how we're all talking about it all over the world at the moment, it seems.
Thank you so much to both of you for joining us. Rajvinder Samra, the lecturer at the School of Health, Wellbeing and Social Care at the Open University. Amelia Nagoski, co-author of Burnout, The Secret to Unlocking the Stress Cycle. We will continue our conversation on Embodied just ahead as we continue to break down burnout. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. Today, it is Embodied, our series about sex, relationships, and your health. And we are talking about burnout. This insidious form of exhaustion affects almost a quarter of full-time workers, according to a 2018 Gallup study. Certain professions tend to be more prone to this phenomenon, like activists. They often face physical and emotional tolls for the work they feel called to do day after day. Emilio Vicente joins me now. He's the communications manager for Familia, Trans Queer Liberation Movement. Emilio, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Anita.
So tell me about when you first started to notice symptoms of burnout in yourself.
Yeah, so I've been active around immigration advocacy and LGBTQ issues for the past 10 years. And I would say around 5 years ago, that's when I started to notice that my health was dramatically declined. And I used a metric of high school for me as like my peak health achievement goals of like I was really active, running around, very mentally and physically well. And it wasn't until like 5 years ago that I started getting symptoms of not feeling well. I saw a dramatic increase of weight gain, which for me was abnormal, not what I was used to. And that was also around the time that, as an undocumented person, presidential elections in 2016 were starting, and we saw a lot of attack on immigrants. And just all of this continued attack on immigrants in general. I would say that's when I started realizing something wasn't right.
And you had a particular experience, I guess this was back when you were in college. You ran for student body president for the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and you lost that election. Tell me what your takeaway was after you lost.
Yeah, so that was actually my first time on this program after I lost that election. And my takeaway at the time was I felt that I had this duty because I was given this opportunity to go to college as an undocumented student. I was given the scholarship that I had to do more for my community. And for me at the time, it meant taking on, being more involved actively, starting new organizations, just speaking out more on immigration. And at the time, it felt like the right thing to do. But reflecting back, I think what I should have done is taken a pause and just reflected on all of the things that I'd been through. And instead, I just got really involved. And I think that really led to a lot of anxiety, stress, overeating, all of these symptoms of just being tired and not recognizing it at the time that maybe I should take a break, slow down, and just take a breather, which I feel like for the past 10 years I haven't really done yet. And it's a weird thing for me to even think about.
It's interesting because we spoke a little bit earlier about this big piece that was published in BuzzFeed earlier this year about millennial burnout. And there have been a lot of responses to it. And one of the criticisms that I read was from a young Black activist who said, some people are allowed to be tired and other people just aren't. And I wonder what you think about that and if that resonates with your experience.
That 100% resonates with my experience. As someone directly affected by an issue, specifically immigration and LGBTQ issues, there isn't a day where I don't think about these issues, and there isn't a switch where I can just turn off these issues and not think about them. Because the reality is, especially for marginalized communities, communities of color, communities that are continually attacked by policies at the local, state, and federal level. It's you can't just disassociate your who you are and from one day to the next go on and try to do something else, which is when all of this started happening, one of the first therapists that I saw told me, why don't you just take a break and try something else, which for me was a very bizarre thing to think about, because the reality is even just a simple fact of going to a therapist and talking about this is a reality for many of people like me that they don't have access to. And so I can't just pause and do something else, because we are affected by all of these issues on a daily basis, even if we don't want to think about them.
So we've been talking throughout the show about one of the things in Emilia Nagoski's book. You kind of have the stress, and you can maybe find ways to treat that: physical exercise, emotional connection, that kind of thing. And then you have the stressors, some of which are systemic, right. And mm-hmm. others of which are not. And I wonder for you, I mean, working in activism day after day in a particular climate, how do you define what success looks like? Have you been able to change your relationship with success to kind of help you experience less burnout?
Yeah. And I would say that I started doing that more consciously as I became more involved. So I look at everything through immigration advocacy and LGBTQ advocacy. What I've realized about success is that you have to think about long term, that you might not be able to have an impact within the next few weeks or days or months, that it might take a few years. And that's also been helpful in not having these rigid structures of what success is and redefining again what success is, because even as we talk about immigration now, coming out and saying you're undocumented has really changed the conversation, and that didn't happen over a few days or months. That's happened over many years of people speaking out, and I would say that's one way of like reframing what success looks like.
I want to play a clip now from one of our callers who shared her experience of burnout with us. This is Carly from Raleigh.
Hi, this is Carly from Raleigh. And as a woman of color and a young woman of color, I think that a lot of us have been taught that in order to stay competitive in our fields, that we must be twice as good as our peers. That's something that a lot of people of color, I know my dad's generation and before that even, that they were taught that mindset. And while some of that might still be true, I think sometimes it can go a little too far. And I'm one of those types of people that I will dive into a project and be completely submersed just to stay on top of the game. And I think particularly people of color need to watch out for that.
That's a listener named Carly sharing her experience with burnout. And I'm talking with activist Emilio Vicente now for this episode of Embodied, our series about sex, relationships, and your health. And Carly didn't want to give her last name because she's still working in that workplace. But what about what she said? Does anything resonate with you from what she said?
Yeah, a lot of what she's saying resonates. I think that especially going into spaces that aren't traditionally for people of color, like there's like that added stress and added weight of like having to prove yourself. And a lot of times, like she said, like working like twice as hard to do the same work that other people are doing, or working twice as hard, that added to make sure that you're in these spaces, I think adds, again, even more can add long-term health effects that can dramatically hurt you physically and mentally. That resonates.
I want to bring in another guest to the conversation now to talk about another group of people who are particularly vulnerable to burnout, nonprofit workers. Kayla Blado is the president of the Nonprofit Professional Employees Union, also the director of media relations for the Economic Policy Institute. Kayla, welcome.
Hi, thanks so much.
So we've been talking about a variety of kinds of burnout today, how it looks different for different professions. And I would love to hear your perspective on kind of what makes it unique for nonprofit workers.
Sure. Well, as your guests have mentioned, this isn't a unique phenomena to any particular profession. But nonprofit workers, as Emilio mentioned, I find a lot of similarities when I heard him talking about feeling burnt out at work because he is driven by the mission of the organization and his daily work. And so nonprofit workers, especially at places like advocacy organizations that are working to help underserved populations, they're really easily overworked because they care about the organization and the mission. And so they put in longer hours for lower pay. They're expected to be on call nights and weekends. And a lot of times, you know, they're not getting the same amount of upward mobility that they would at a public sector job or in another private sector. Oftentimes, nonprofit organizations are homogenous because wages tend to be lower. And so people of color might feel particularly out of place there if they work there because they might be one of a few of their colleagues who can actually independently afford to work there, but also might have to work. People have to work multiple jobs because wages are low. And so turnover ends up being higher. So there's really a lot of reasons that, you know, pick any of these, why nonprofit workers face high levels of stress and burnout. But our union is basically working to break the cycle and create a structure to fix some of these systemic issues.
Well, how do you do that? Because in nonprofit work, there's kind of this idea a lot of times that, you know, your passion for doing this should be what drives you. That should be what brings you to work every day. And like, we wish we could pay you more, but ultimately, we're a nonprofit and we just aren't going to be able to do that. How does a union contract help balance the tension between keeping costs low and treating workers more fairly?
Well, a union is really just having a voice on the job. So a union is a group of your coworkers coming together and establishing priorities and figuring out solutions to problems that are facing you and your coworkers. So if pay is an issue, if healthcare is an issue, vacation days, sick days, workplace culture, things like this, it really is just coming together and working on solutions and then talking to management and figuring out ways in which you can address them collectively. And, you know, nonprofits are notorious for low wages and having shoestring budgets. But, I mean, a lot of nonprofits are working on issues like poverty and inequality. And so by offering low wages and no benefits to their employees, they're kind of just perpetuating that cycle.
So North Carolina is a right-to-work state, so public employees can't collectively bargain. So what kind of message would you give to teachers who hear this and say, that sounds amazing, but we don't have that option here?
Sure. Well, so I know that North Carolina teachers have been really active in the last few years. They had walkouts in 2018 and in 2019 so far from all across the state with thousands of workers. You know, they're fighting for their own goals of raising wages, getting compensation for advanced degrees, and providing more classroom support. And so those are issues that affect not only teachers, but the community. And so I think that in this moment, they feel like they have the space to do this because unions the support for unions are at a 16-year high. We've seen teachers walking out all across the country saying enough is enough. Their wages are too low, you know, and I feel like, you know, and a lot of teachers are millennials, too, and who tend to have a higher view of unions. And so, you know, teachers are working together and they're trying to change these things. So I would just say, you know, keep fighting for your causes, keep fighting for respect on the job, for dignity, you know, and I think that a lot of these are working and we're seeing a lot of victories across the country for teachers.
Emilio, how do you think activists and people in caring professions could be better supported by other people, even if these systemic changes are slow to happen?
Yeah, so I definitely agree with that. I think one way is forming a union at your job. I think nonprofits have to live their values of paying their workers and also not overworking them. That's one very tangible thing that can happen. Another way of supporting people is not putting full expectations on them as the people who have to solve all of these systemic issues, because they're systemic and they're not going to change overnight. I think that another way to help is honestly just asking and making this like more of commonly talking about how we can take care of each other, which I feel like it's becoming a more conversation that everyone is accepting. And I think that also changes how we see work and what work means and, like earlier, what success means.
I want to play both of you a little montage from some of our listeners, some of whom we've heard from this show, talking about how they've addressed their burnout and tips for other people. So let's listen.
Every single day, you need to take a meta view of who you are, what your goals are, and whether your day-to-day life are in line with the profession that you envisioned and the lifestyle that you envisioned for yourself.
I know what worked for me was doing a positivity journal, and this, you know, campy as that sounds, it actually worked because it forced me to reflect on the day and think about the things that were going on. And when I started noticing a trend that it was really hard to find things to be positive about at the end of the day, that's when I started realizing that I needed to make a change.
Be real with yourself and your expectations of yourself, and know that if you've gotten to this point, it's probably because you had those expectations set a little too high. And that's totally okay. But be honest with yourself and others.
I think the biggest takeaway is that it's never too late to do something else. People are scared, but oftentimes you don't need to be scared. You just need to actually do what's right for you, even if it feels really uncomfortable.
That was A.R. Abdelbar, Krista Malo, Elizabeth, and Jack Wiggins sharing their tips on burnout. I only have about 30 seconds left, but I'd love to hear in closing from both of you, Kayla, maybe you first, and then Emilio, any tips that you have for other people that may be experiencing burnout?
Sure. I mean, the journaling and other types of self-care that I've brought up are very important, but I think that that shifts the burden back onto the person who is feeling burnout and who is a victim of these systemic issues. And so I would say forming a union is one way to address these issues before they become stressors and fix them at your workplace with your colleagues so that you can prevent burnout across your organization.
Emilio?
Yeah, apart from that, how I've approached it is changing my eating habits, my daily habits, and more excitedly, I got a dog last year, a corgi, and she's been phenomenal. Obviously, not everyone can do that, but having someone or some being or something that you can attach yourself to and that resonates with you, doing something that you love, for me, has been one of those like stepping stones towards also approaching how I try to take care of myself on a daily basis, and also recognizing that you're not going to solve this within the next few days. You have to be intentional about that as well.
Your corgi helps you complete the stress cycle, Emilio. It's perfect. You tied the whole show together. Thank you so much, Emilio Vicente and Kayla Bledo. Emilio is a communications manager for Familia Trans Queer Liberation Movement, and Kayla is the president of the Nonprofit Professional Employees Union, also the director of media relations for the Economic Policy Institute. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
You can find out more about the show, everything we talked about today, and the Embodied series at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.